From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. The oceans have the capacity to enthrall us if we let them. With increasingly urgent challenges on the global level, it's tempting to turn our attention elsewhere. But we ignore the oceans at our own peril.
The magnitude of what we invest in space exploration is many times more than what we've invested in ocean exploration and research. And that's pretty sad, given that it's our one planet that's covered three-quarters almost with ocean.
Today, why the oceans matter, and stories and science to reacquaint us with the mysterious fathoms below.
I have a whole archive of newspaper clippings about people who said they were saved by dolphins. Even little Ilian Gonzalez, the child who was in the Cuban situation where he was hanging onto a life raft when they were trying to come from Cuba to the United States, reported that he was surrounded by dolphins, and every time he slipped off the raft, the dolphins would push him back up onto it.
Also, why you should read Moby Dick. Ellen Prager wants you to care about the oceans. She's a writer and former chief scientist of the Aquarius Reef Base, the world's only undersea research station. Her latest book is called Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime. At first glance, it might seem like a lighthearted romp through the world of weird and wild sea creatures. But Prager's fixed her sights on something bigger. She wants to remind people why the oceans are enchanting and why we need to protect them. She told Steve Paulson about a few good reasons we should care.
I don't think many people know how the ocean necessarily relates to human health, that it's the new frontier for drug discovery. There are already medications on the market, drugs on the market, to fight cancer, inflammation, pain that come from compounds from marine organisms, or that marine animals are being used as models to better understand human physiology.
Really? In what way, models to understand human physiology?
There's so many examples that it's even hard to pick one out. The squid, surprisingly enough, has very large neurons or nerve cells. And so scientists study squid nerves to better understand the nervous system and diseases that may impact the nervous system. There are fish that have low calcium bones. They're called ice fish. And so scientists are studying those fish to look at things like osteoporosis. The list, I can't even tell you how long that list is. There's already one painkiller actually on the market from the venom of the cone snail. It's called Prialt. And the real advantage of this is that people who are addicted or allergic to morphine can take this non-opiate drug from the venom of a cone snail.
I mean, what's remarkable about this is these things would seem to be so different from our own species, Homo sapiens. I mean, the cone snail, the squid, and yet you're saying there's something that we share with them.
Well, there is. The other thing to think about is that these animals have been evolving much longer than we have, in a sense. They've been evolving for hundreds of millions of years. And so there are parts of their biology that we can learn from. And that, I think, is a really, for me, interesting look at why the diversity of creatures in the sea is so important. Because not only learning about their biology, but now we're also looking at how can we model things we use in our society after them. This is a great one. There are people designing fan blades, you know, rotating fan blades based on the fin of a humpback whale.
Wow.
Because it's aerodynamic when they jump up. And so we're starting to model some of the things we make after these incredible systems that have evolved in the sea.
Huh. Wow. That's amazing. Well, speaking of the diversity of species, You mentioned in your book that you never realized all of the strange sex going on in the ocean. What did you find most surprising?
Okay, you had to bring that up.
You bet.
You can't resist. Well, again, you know, nature has evolved many different ways, not only for mating to occur, but for, you know, offspring to be produced and survive. So there are a lot of different strategies. I didn't realize all of these, in some cases, fairly odd strategies. Things like there are swimming snails that start as males, mate as males, they swap sperm, and then they change into females. once they change into females, it's pretty handy. They've already got the sperm. They're ready to go. It's, you know, there's no gender problem, no relationship issues. Pretty good.
Are there enough males to go around then?
Well, you know, there's plenty of males because then they change into females. So when they're born, you know, they're born as males. So
and they're all born as males and then eventually end up as females?
Yeah, they start as males. And then once they swap sperm, they change into females.
So what you're describing are species that change their bodies dramatically at times. I mean, to the point where you wouldn't even recognize them from one day to the next.
Well, they do. And that, you know, one of the very interesting things is, how do they do that? Another example of that that I think is fascinating is that there are a lot of animals in the ocean that can regenerate body parts. An example is the sea cucumber, which seems to be this docile log on the seafloor. But if predators threaten it, it's able to eviscerate, meaning it can eject its internal organs, which is, you know, kind of disgusting. It's like if a mugger came up to you and I and we sort of vomited up our, you know, lungs. But the advantage is they can use that as a decoy, slowly crawl away, and they can regenerate their internal organs within 3 to 5 weeks. Imagine if we understood how that works.
Yeah. There's another very strange fish that you write about, the hagfish, which lives, for instance, right off the coast of Maine.
The hagfish lives in sort of deep, cold, salty water, and it has sort of gruesome feeding techniques, I guess you could say. Really two claims of fame. It's feeding and its ability to produce copious amounts of slime.
Okay. Well, first of all, let's talk about the feeding.
So they have a tongue that has sort of like two rows of teeth on it, but it's not very good for biting through scales or tough fish flesh. So they must find other ways to get inside a fish for access to its tasty organs and flesh. So they go in through the mouth, through the gills, and I'm sorry to say, the back door. In through the butt. They are shaped like eels. They look very much like eels, although they're fish, but they are long and fairly skinny, slippery, no scales. So they kind of slither in. And, you know, I will say, burial at sea, no longer an option for me. Hagfish. Hagfish.
Yeah, okay. So you mentioned there's a slime factor as well.
Oh, great slime factor. So their other sort of claim to fame is that when they are threatened by predators or injury, they can produce huge quantities of slime very fast. Within minutes, they could produce enough to fill 7 buckets of slime.
Do we pretty much understand oceans now, or are there still big mysteries out there?
Huge mysteries out there. You know, we're always discovering new species. Only something like 5 to 10% of the ocean has even been explored. There are species we haven't found yet, undoubtedly. There's plenty of animals we've seen at the surface, but we don't really know what they do day in and day out. If you think about it, whales, dolphins, even fish, we see them at the surface. We don't know what they do the rest of the day and night. And so it's a very hidden world from us, and because of that, we really don't know that much. Ocean research and education have not been a priority for this country for a long time. And in fact, like everything else, it's really taking a hit with what's going on in the debt crisis. And it continues not to be a priority. I mean, if you look at what we invest in space exploration, and I'm not saying that's bad, I'm just saying the magnitude of what we invest in space exploration is many times more than what we've invested in ocean exploration and research. And that's pretty sad, given that it's our one planet that's covered, you know, 3/4 almost with ocean.
What would you say are the most important things to do to try to save the oceans?
Well, I don't think there's one thing we can do to save the oceans. I think it's sort of a toolkit for success. It's a number of things we need to do. We need to cultivate ocean champions, people at the highest level in our government and in our local communities that are going to be champions for the ocean and recognize the importance of the oceans to their communities and to people and to the nation. We need bottom level grassroots education outreach. We have not invested hardly anything in that. Good examples in the Gulf of Mexico, the money coming from the BP oil spill, very little of it's going to education outreach, which I personally think is a huge mistake. We need marine reserves, not huge areas, but enough areas so that there are places where the ocean can basically take a rest from human activities and recuperate. These are no-take areas where the fish, you can't fish, you can't boat, so that you have other places in the area in the ocean where you can do that. We need better policies on fishing, better technologies to reduce bycatch, aquaculture policies that don't take wild fish necessarily to feed farm fish. Doesn't really make too much sense. So it's a suite of things. No one of those is going to solve the problems. But I think a big part of it is getting the public engaged. And that was a big reason for me to write this book, was to use the hook of these wacky creature stories, but to try and get people to recognize our connections to the invaluable resources the ocean provides and why we need to do better at protecting it and preserving it.
Ellen Prager is a writer and former chief scientist at the world's only undersea research station, Aquarius Reef Base in the Florida Keys. She's the author of Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime. Steve Paulson spoke with her. I'm Jim Fleming. Coming up next, the story of Herman Melville and his great white whale. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Nathaniel Philbrick thinks everyone should read Moby Dick. It was a seminal book for Philbrick, who heard the call of the sea in its masterful narrative. Need some encouragement? Here's a taste.
The ship dash on, my men, will ye not save my ship? But as the oarsmen violently forced their boat through the sledge-hammering seas, the before whale-smitten bow ends of two planks burst through, and in an instant almost, the temporarily disabled boat lay nearly level with the waves, its half-wading, splashing crew trying hard to stop the gap and bail out the pouring water. The whale! The whale! Up helm! Up helm! Oh, all ye sweet powers of air, now hug me close. Oh, Ahab, Ahab, lo thy work. Steady, helmsman, steady. Nay, up helm again. He turns to meet us. Oh, his unappeasable brow drives on towards one whose duty tells him he cannot depart. Oh, my God, stand by me now.
An excerpt from Moby Dick, read by Carl Schmidt. According to Nathaniel Philbrick, Melville's classic Moby Dick will always be worth our time and attention, no matter the age. And in his new book, Why Read Moby Dick, he goes even farther.
Yeah, I go so far as to say it's about as close as anything we have to an American Bible. It's as much a repository as it is the story of a whaling voyage. And in there is just so much of what makes America America, particularly in the mid-19th century, but delivered with such a poetic beauty, it resonates in any time. Yes, it's a big, imposing book, but there is so much in there that I think anyone at some point in their lives will find pleasure and real great learning in that book.
I mean, that's the thing about it, isn't it? It's a challenging book. There isn't any question of that. But there's so much of it. It's history. It's realism. It is, as you said, a description of the time and place. In fact, it's kind of a time capsule of New England, isn't it? The whaling industry.
Absolutely. It contains you know, pretty much the DNA of America at that time. And it's being a kind of genetic code, I think it applies to pretty much all times Americans find themselves in. But, you know, it's, yes, it's about a whaling voyage, but Melville is so careful to link it through similes and metaphors to scenes from the interior of the country that it's all there. And as a writer, it's just, I'm continually amazed at just the level of the writing. There's all sorts of kinds of writing, from poetry to parody writing to, you know, a short story is inserted in this, and then there's all sorts of Shakespearean drama going on. And so that it's kind of a postmodern novel written in the 19th century, so that there's a real almost experimental nature about it that I think is immensely appealing.
But it's also just a decade before the Civil War, which, looking back on it, makes you realize how much of America he was writing about.
Yeah, he wrote this at a very important sort of historical moment. In 1850, America passed the Fugitive Slave Act, which meant that a slave that had escaped from the southern states to the north now had to legally be returned to his or her slave master. And this meant that the north was now bound to this institution that had pretty much been seen as a local southern problem. And riots broke out in Boston, where Melville's father-in-law was a judge. All the passions that would eventually erupt 10 years later in the Civil War were right there as Melville was writing Moby Dick. And this meant that I think the book has an incredible portrait of a society on the brink of a cataclysm. It's not just the Pequod hurtling towards its encounter with a white whale. This is America hurtling towards the conflict that will ultimately define it in a terrifying and a liberating way.
Of course, the book actually didn't do very well right at the beginning, and it was another cataclysm that brought it to light, I guess. The First World War was what introduced it to a variety of people who saw in it the lessons that he was trying perhaps to teach about the Civil War recurring.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the book dropped like a stone in 1851 when it was published, and when Melville died 40 years later, it was had really sort of fallen off the literary radar screen, and it wouldn't be until the other side of World War I. And I think you're right. The world had to experience a cataclysm of that scale to sort of catch up to where Melville had been 10 years before the Civil War. And so that what you see is in the 1920s, Moby Dick becomes kind of the in book for young writers. In Paris, the expats used it as a kind of litmus test. If you liked Moby Dick, you had the goods. Faulkner, a southern land-based writer, said that the one book he wished he had written that he hadn't was Melville's Moby Dick.
You know, I think if you were to ask most people what they know about Moby Dick, they would probably quote, "Call me Ishmael," but they might not know who Ishmael is. They would certainly know about the great white whale, and they would almost certainly mention Ahab with his peg leg. But in fact, the white whale and Ahab are latecomers to the book,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, you know, it is very interesting. I think it's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to make a movie out of Moby Dick. The leading, most dramatic characters, Ahab and the white whale, come quite late. You don't see Ahab until they've left Nantucket and they're well along, and the white whale doesn't appear until the last three chapters, and it is all a prelude in many ways, this novel. And what Melville does is very carefully, almost meticulously, prepare us for this truly titanic encounter between Ahab and the white whale, and it really ends with a terrific bang. And I encourage all readers that it's worth getting through all those preliminary chapters, because the final payoff is some of the great action writing ever composed.
And Ahab, whom we see as this obsessed maniac, this revenge-filled captain, to his crew, at least in the beginning, has all the remarkable traits of a leader, a compelling, mm-hmm. share-my-vision captain.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the more profound things that Melville gets at, is the unsettling nature of leadership, of great people. That charismatic center is so often based on actual problems the person has. At one point, Ishmael says that all mortal greatness is but disease. And I think that is an essential truth when it comes to leadership. And there is something ennobling about Ahab's quest to solve all the problems of the world, to punch through what he calls that pasteboard mask and try to identify what is really going on in this life. And yet, it's a truly demented quest in which he has seized control of a vessel and is very willing to sacrifice the lives of everyone on board to achieve his goal. And I think Melville is showing us that how morality is so shifty and hard to tell. What is evil? What is good? And there's the character of Starbuck, who is, by all rights, a very decent, good man, who is the second in command and recognizes just how crazy Ahab is. And yet he doesn't, in the end, act to stop him. And is he evil as a consequence for doing that? I mean, it's just fascinating to see what Melville is working out in this novel.
So how many times have you read Moby Dick?
I'm thinking it's close to a dozen. Each time I've read it, it's amazing. It seems like a different book. Not only do you find things that you may have missed, but you know, you change as a reader as you come at it a slightly different direction. And so it's, for me, just been a real important part of life.
Led Zeppelin's track Moby Dick. Nathaniel Philbrick is the author of Why Read Moby Dick? He lives next to the sea on Nantucket. TT Book essayist and producer Veronica Rickert has had her own close encounter with whales on a first visit to SeaWorld in San Diego. For Veronica, laying eyes on an orca was stranger than she'd ever imagined.
I lost my mind at SeaWorld. In Shamu Stadium, a basic array of cement bleachers flanking a tank of swimming pool blue water. The light that morning was surreal, making Wisconsin sunlight look like an off-brand, the kind sold out of someone's trunk in Eau Claire. The whole setup was kind of bizarre, too. Here we all were, about to squeal with delight, while the most dangerous predator in the world jumped through a hoop or something before we all shuffled out again to eat some nachos. I should have been enjoying the pre-orca tingles like everyone else. But there I was, unable to enjoy the moment, alone with my dark thoughts. And Jacques Cousteau. In some of my bleaker moments as a child, I cursed his name, his professional calling, his plucky little retreating flippers flapping past the giants of the deep. Why blame a visionary Frenchman who is indisputably hailed as a hero for his undersea documentaries and marine conservation efforts? Because he made hours of my childhood a maritime hell.
In the Antarctic, we have seen very few large whales, but packs of killer whales still thrive.
Years later, I can still see myself watching Something by Cousteau on TV through clawed fingers, on that bastion of nature-induced terror otherwise known as PBS. Inspired by Cousteau, my mom brought home an immense whale book with Titanic color photographs. I moved it to a faraway room when she wasn't looking. During baths, I scrunched myself into the far corner, away from the sinister drain, which at any moment would open and release one of the pea-eyed great white sharks circling just beneath our Midwestern bathroom. It would devour me in two greedy gulps, eyes rolled back into its head while it chomped in gastronomic delight, like Julia Child on a beef marrow bender. Some children have monsters under the bed, vampires in the closet, boogeymen beneath the blankets piled up in the corner. I had killer whales and sharks. Every time I closed my eyes, I was tormented by unwilling visions of their sleek bodies, tricked out in form-fitting pleather, swimming reconnaissance around the perimeter of my mind. Around the time I was in fifth grade, we visited the Apple Valley Zoo in Minnesota, famous for being one of the few Midwestern zoos to house actual flesh-and-blood whales, the small and sociable beluga. As we made the descent to the underground whale observatory, it grew dim. The only light filtered through thousands of metric tons of water. Sliding into view, there were the whales, languidly spinning upside down or shooting past at startling speed. In a beat, they twist out of sight around the bend in their enclosure, like albino quarks, ceasing to exist when I lost my faith. It was too much, too soon. And in the deep of the night, I had nightmares about the light shivering its way through the water, the black eyes of the white whales. But Cousteau wasn't through with me yet. Instead, he slipped in through a side door that cracked open on a meditation retreat on the West Coast when I was in my 20s. The retreat happened to be situated along a deliriously beautiful strip of California coast, tucked on a bluff above the Pacific Ocean. My mother was along, and being the avidest of birdwatchers, and apparently the most distractible of meditators, she always brought her binoculars along with her. We'd sit alongside each other, on cement benches, facing all that water, meditating, peeking at the ocean, then trying to meditate again, feeling the last of the day sun on our faces. It was during one of these flash twilights that I heard a gasp and looked up to see my mom training her binoculars out to sea, past the surfer straddling their boards in the calm water, to bursts of silver gently erupting from the waves below. It was a pod of dolphins cruising the coast for a bedtime snack, bobbing in and out of the ocean's arms. Occasionally, an especially spry dolphin would blow off some steam by blasting out in a leap and diving below. Even without the binoculars, they were spellbinding. The surfers had spotted the dolphins, too, and were paddling out to meet them, going farther out to sea. After that, I read up on my subject. Turns out, dolphins don't have a perfect record either, just like the killer whales and sharks that had tormented me as a kid. It's been noted before that human beings are awkward bags of mostly water stuck on land. So maybe that's it. We came from the sea primordial, and that's where the water in us wants to return at an atomic level, rendering us finely calibrated human divining rods, whether or not we choose to listen. It could be that Cousteau was on to something after all. His work was too graphic for my child's imagination, but he had seen something, too. Something human and divine all at once. Cousteau had brought me to the door of the other, where I stood, 1 foot in, 1 foot out, needing to name my fear but lacking the language. So I did what I could. I reduced the oceans to a level I could control and consume. I went to SeaWorld. As I sat that day, feeling the old uneasiness jostling around in my gut, 2 megascreen TVs powered up on either side of the orca tank, a melodious male voice was telling a story about a boy and the ocean. In the story, shot in black and white for maximum gravitas, the boy lived near the ocean. He dreamed of seeing an orca and carved an orca pendant made of wood, which he wore around his neck at all times. One day, the boy took his kayak out to sea, and you just knew something was going to happen. But in case he were a clueless landlubber, the music ballooned cinematically. The boy was paddling in his kayak out to sea, the orca pendant swinging from his neck. His eyes were trained on the waves, when suddenly a killer whale hurled itself out of the water next to the kayak. The boy was overcome with rapture, and the music reached an unbearable climax as the boy and whale seemed to have some kind of deeply soulful moment of recognition. As I blinked, the screens went dim. And a beat later, an actual orca exploded from the water a mere 5 rows away. Maybe it was SeaWorld's masterful pre-orca priming of the pump. Maybe it was the ghost of Cousteau finally set free. But as the real live orca sped past us, I had a good old-fashioned breakdown. There was weeping, gnashing of teeth, shivering. If I'd had a tunic on, I imagine I would have happily shredded it in the style of classical Greek tragedy. At the physicality of the whale right there in front of me, in all its speed and glory, the atoms in my body surged, rearranged themselves, drunk on electricity. The impossibility that I shared a planet with a species like the killer whale and had never really known or understood what that meant drowned my mind while I sat transfixed,
Cousteau was right, I thought I heard a tiny French voice singing out. Cousteau was right. The orca blasting through air and water was, in some senses, an abomination of what a whale should be. Feel free to rent Free Willy for more on that topic. And yet, the trainers, the Chernobyl blue water, the applause, none of it could take away the essence of the being I saw before me. It was petrifying, but it was also lovely, like a cyclone or a rogue wave is beautiful even as it tears you apart. It was nature unmasked, both the exaltation of the dolphin and the gravity of the great white shark. The creative force of the world is something too big to hold in our minds. All we can do is promise not to look away. I staggered out of Shamu Stadium in shreds, my former self held together by skin and bones and something like biological destiny. A month or two after we saw the Shamu show, an orca bull named Tilikum killed a trainer at SeaWorld in Orlando, Florida, dragging her through the water like a toy and raising questions about whether or not it was hubris to have the world's most dangerous predator perform in captivity, whether we could ever really understand orca behavior well enough to prevent another such tragedy. The Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore wrote, "You will never know the world aright until the sea itself floweth in your veins, until you are as familiar with the universe as your walk and table." Until that day, in Shamu Stadium, the oceans were an idea to me, the airy strand of a dream that slips away before it can be pinioned down on the specimen board of your mind. Now I know the color of an orca eye, the angle of its teeth, the tornadic thrash of its tail, even if its mind is like the Louvre, with rooms inside I'll never see.
Veronica Rickert is a TT Book producer and essayist. Coming up, we get a glimpse inside the mind of a dolphin. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and Public Radio International. If the sea has a voice, how can we learn to hear it? James McManus chews on that question in his first novel, The Language of the Sea. The book tells the story of a marine biologist who slips away from his old life and takes up residence with a group of seals living in the waters off Cape Cod. He told Anne Strangechamps about his main character, Leo.
Leo Kemp is a marine biologist, and he specializes in the study of seals, and in particular, their secret underwater language. Leo is an awkward character. He challenges some of the big assumptions that of big science, and he finds himself at odds, therefore, with the institution's establishment. He gets himself fired, but he's allowed to take his students on one final research trip. And he does so, taking them on an old tug just off the Cape Cod coast. So he takes his students out on an old tug off to Monomoy Island, there to watch seals and, much more importantly, to monitor their underwater language by dropping hydrophones into the water.
How much do scientists actually know about the language of seals?
They know a great deal about it because sound underwater, as you probably know, travels a huge distance. So that a seal, using its rumbling, clickety-click language off the Scottish coast, can be heard and understood by a seal off the Norwegian coast, several hundred miles, well, 100 miles at least, distant. And what the seals talk about to each other is the presence of enemies, hostile creatures like killer whales, where to find food, amorous conversations in order to meet mates, and so on and so forth. It's the normal chitter-chatter that one would expect to find among animals of that kind, But of course, what really intrigues scientists is how they actually create and decode their language, because it's all a click language. Mm. And they've got very close, scientists, at the moment, to determining how whales communicate. So we're not far off understanding how seals can do the same thing.
Leo winds up having a much closer and deeper and more sustained encounter with both the ocean and the seals than he had anticipated. He's out on this boat with his students. A sudden storm comes up. He winds up washed overboard. And I want to ask you to read what happens next.
Leo reckoned he'd been swimming up the coast with his pod of seals for about half an hour. They could swim at great speed, up to 15 miles an hour, but this group was slipping easily and much more slowly through the water. Once he ducked his head beneath the surface and forced himself to open his eyes and sighted a shoal of fish a few yards away. Seals have bifocal vision, which allows them to see and hunt beneath the surface of the water as well as on land. Human beings do not. Further evidence that this is my death dream, he thought. This must be what happens when you drown. Death just becomes a dream, a ghostly imagining on the way from one world to the next. He had always taken life as it came. Now he would take death as it came. The pod of seals turned shoreward as it reached the point and headed for a small group of seaweed-covered rocks. Leo turned with them, swimming strongly until his feet found the rising seabed. The seals hauled themselves up onto the rocks, paying no attention to Leo as he crawled ashore. He lay back on a bed of seaweed and looked up at the blue-grey gloaming. He felt his pulse. I am not dead. I have survived. So this is the ultimate research trip. Why shouldn't I swim with seals? See the fish they see. Watch them as they swim, feed and rest. Because the human body cannot do that, came the small voice of logic and reason. You're not a seal, so how can you hang out with them?
Now, on the one hand, this seems extraordinary. And on the other, you make the point several times that the history of humans and seals has been all wound up together for centuries. Didn't you write that there are actually cave paintings, ancient cave paintings of seals?
Absolutely. If you go up the Scandinavian coast, you can see early man painted not just the famous paintings that we know of the caves of France, of animals, but of seals, because seals were a vital part of sustaining their lifestyle then. As I say, they provided food, meat, musky though it sounds, but it was edible, and their pelts made very, very good clothing.
Mm. So they've been part of human history for a long time, also part of our myths. There's an ancient Celtic myth or a series of them about Selkies.
That's right. Even to this day, if you go around the Celtic Rim of Great Britain, that is the islands off the coast of Scotland and Ireland, west of Ireland, you can still find old fishermen who will tell you that on the longest and darkest night of the year, in the middle of winter, a seal or seals will come ashore and transform themselves into a beautiful woman who will marry a local fisherman, have his children, live with him for many years, and then on a similar dark night, that woman will walk back into the sea and become a seal again, leaving behind broken hearts and empty beds.
Hmm. Would you read from this section where Leo actually sort of imagines himself as a Selkie? I wondered if you'd read a bit of that section.
Leo fantasized about compressing a million years into as many minutes and becoming a true seal, able to swim, dive, and sleep at sea as they did. He would roam the seas of the world and maybe one day appear in a human form like the Selkies of the old myths. He would emerge from the sea on a lonely Scottish island, shed his skin to become a handsome young visitor seeking long-lost relatives and sweep a blue-eyed Celtic girl off her feet. He would woo her, bed her, wed her, and father find children with her. Then, on the longest night of the year, in the depths of winter, he would shed his thin, milk-white man-skin and slip back into the warm, blubbery cloak of the sea creature he really was, and return to the waves where he belonged.
Leo, for a while, loses human language when he's hanging out with the seals, and your book is called The Language of the Sea. I suppose that's what Leo learns, the language of the sea. What does that phrase mean to you, and what would it mean for all of us to learn a bit more of the language of the sea?
Well, it's a metaphor. It does mean that he learns to sort of converse with the sea, if you like, to almost treat it as somebody with whom he's living and with whom he has to get on and converse with. And don't forget also that Leo is studying, and his speciality is the language of seals. So to some extent, that is the language that's talked below the waves. And it's not, as I explained earlier on, it's not just seals. Whales and dolphins, too, have this extraordinary ability to communicate beneath the sea. So I think that's really what the title means. It means the sea is there, it talks to us, there is a language of those extraordinary oceans. And it's to some extent a language that we've forgotten, we've ignored it. We are really not treating those oceans very well, and we really do depend upon them to survive on this planet. I mean, there are going to be, 6 billion? There are 6 billion people on the planet now. We can't all fly to Mars and live somewhere else. Our future is on this planet, and we have to accept that the oceans are very much a part of that future.
James McManus is the managing director of the Times Literary Supplement and the author of The Language of the Sea. Anne Strangechamp spoke with him. Audio from the piece was provided by freesound.org. Diana Reese is out to save dolphin lives. If animals with developed self-awareness deserve greater protections, then dolphins should be at the top of the list. Reese directs the Dolphin Research Program at the National Aquarium in Baltimore and is a professor in the psychology department at Hunter College. She writes about her findings on dolphin intelligence in the book Dolphin in the Mirror. She told Steve Paulson that humans and dolphins have more in common than we think.
They couldn't be more different than us, yet their brains are a lot like ours in several ways, and what they do with them is a lot like what we do. So, for example, they have really big, complex brains like we do, like the great apes do, like elephants have. And these brains have two hemispheres, but they're organized a bit differently. And there's some differences in the sense that we have frontal lobes and we can't identify any exact region that we would call the frontal lobe, but there may be different areas that function like frontal lobes, you know, that process information in similar ways. But dolphins like us, like the great apes, like elephants, show mirror self-recognition. That type of intelligence. And that's a level of self-awareness that we thought was uniquely human.
You actually put a spot, you marked them in a place that they ordinarily couldn't see. I mean, they could only see it in the mirror.
Correct. And that's a test called the mark test. And again, once the dolphins show self-directed behavior or the chimps show it, or children, it's generally considered they're showing mirror self-recognition. The mark test is another way to verify that they understand it's themselves. So they're marked in different parts of their body. And then will they go to the mirror and orient that part of their body right away to the mirror to see it? Or if that's true for the dolphins. For people, for kids or for chimps, they can touch the mark. But the non-handed dolphin, we had to come up with a way to show this without them touching it. So we marked them in many different places. And they would race to the mirror and orient right away to the mark. They positioned their body so the mark showed. And that was the evidence that we brought forth to show that they, too, can understand themselves. You don't have to be a primate to recognize yourself in a mirror.
So what does that mean, that they can understand themselves? I mean, are you talking about some level of self-consciousness here?
Yeah, I do think that it's a level of self-consciousness. I think it's a level of self-consciousness or self-awareness that most animals don't show. They have to understand that that external representation of themselves is self, and that suggests a sense of self. Beyond that, it's one thing to recognize yourself in a mirror. It's another thing to be interested, curious about what you look like in a mirror, what the inside of your mouth looks like, what your eye looks like close up, what it looks like when you spin in front of a mirror or when you do a particular kind of behavior. I mean, think about our own behavior in a mirror. Don't we often want to know what we look like when we do that new dance step or when we have our hair a certain way? I mean, we're really interested in what is it we look like in general. I mean, that's fairly sophisticated. And again, most animals like dogs and cats, even though they're intelligent in their own ways, simply don't show it. That when they look in the mirror, it simply doesn't compute that it's themselves.
Well, you tell some remarkable stories. One was a dolphin that turned the tables on you. It basically gave you a timeout.
Right. So a timeout, I think many of us are familiar with this. Sometimes if you're having a problem with something or you're working with somebody and you sort of just don't get it, you'll take a timeout or somebody will say, why don't you take a timeout? And they break social contact and you kind of go off your separate ways and think about what's going on. And teachers often use this with children. I was working with a particularly wonderful dolphin named Circe, and she was actually the first dolphin I worked with. And I was working in France. I had a grant from the French government. And in exchange for me studying Circe's behavior as part of my PhD thesis, the person who had this facility said, could you teach her to station in front of you and eat fish that were cut up into three pieces, heads, middles, and tails? So I did that, and I cut this large mackerel into these three sections, heads, middles, and tails. Circe readily ate the heads, quickly ate the middles, but spit out every tail I gave her. And these tails had, you know, tail fins. They were finny, and I thought, well, maybe she didn't like the fins. So I cut the fins off, and I joked that perhaps she was training me how to cut the fish the way she likes, in a sense. But everything was going well. Well, while Circe was learning to station, if she left me when I gave her the station signal, or if she left when I wanted her to stay while she was being fed, I simply gave her a timeout. That meant I backed away from the pool about 10 to 15 feet, stood up, you know, in a vertical position, and just looked at her. And she quickly realized that this was a correction mechanism and quickly learned to stay at station. A few weeks into the work, when she was stationing beautifully, she understood what was being done. I, by accident, fed her an uncut tail. And she sort of bolted up and looked at me, spit out the tail, and went across the tank and took this vertical position against the wall and just stared at me. And everybody, you know, when I tell this story, everybody gets it. You know, I don't have to say she was giving me a timeout or ask the question, was she giving me a timeout? It was apparent to me that she was doing something of that sort. And that meant she may have been understanding the function of this signal and using it back to me. I mean, that's true communication. That's the essence of how communication starts. And this was exactly what I was studying in school, how communication evolves between people or people and other animals. But that was an anecdote.
Yeah. Huh.
And for me as a scientist, I had to do more. So I turned it into an experiment.
So you did this again to see if she would again give you a time.
Yeah. I waited several days and fed her the properly cut tails, and she stayed with me. And then a few days later, I gave her on purpose this time an uncut tail, and I got the same response. She went across the pool. And the other few times I did it, I always got that response. She inspired that experiment.
Yeah. So yeah. Given this level of intelligence that you're describing, there are some ethical issues here. And I know you've been involved in efforts to save dolphins because there are some places, especially in Japan, that kill dolphins. What should we take away from this kind of research in terms of what we know about the suffering that dolphins might experience?
In many places like Japan, particularly a small village named Taiji, these dolphins are killed. They're slaughtered in the most inhumane way.
Why are they killed?
Well, the government says they're killed because they see them as competitors for the fishermen. And there's been a great deal of overfishing in the waters of Japan. And again, Japan is an island, and they rely on the fisheries for their livelihood. But I think it's been well acknowledged and documented that there simply is great overfishing in those waters. And the dolphins are actually being scapegoated. And 34 fishermen with a small number of boats are told to kill dolphins. And these quotas are set by the government of Japan each year. So each year, over 2,000 dolphins can be killed and killed inhumanely in these drive hunts in Taiji. And that's the one area where it's primarily conducted.
And there was a documentary film about this, The Cove, which won an Oscar. And I know you were involved in the making of that film.
I'd never seen so many dolphins before. The Japanese people don't even know about it. They take the boats around to the secret cove that nobody could see. They're afraid of cameras. They said if the world finds out what goes on here, we'll be shut down. They were hiding something.
And you also say that, I mean, dolphins have often an acute sense of pain. I mean, not just from getting killed, but even from getting bruised.
Absolutely. They have really sensitive skin. If you rub your nail on a dolphin, they'll flinch. They have exquisitely sensitive skin. And dolphins are also subject to stress. Stressors can really affect them. They're subject to getting ulcers, both in the wild and in captivity. So, you know, these animals are very sensitive. And if you can imagine highly social animals like this, aware of what's going on around them, being herded by boats into these small bays where they're held for either a short amount of time or longer amounts of time, and then they're slaughtered, and seeing their youngsters around them and youngsters watching their mothers and others being slaughtered around them, I mean, it's just like something out of Dante's Inferno. It's hard to believe that any modern country could participate in something like this. And it's hard for me to believe as a scientist that this hasn't been stopped yet.
What has happened when the Japanese government has been presented with this evidence, which it has? I mean, I know by activists and scientists.
Yeah, we went in to talk to the embassy in D.C., and they just turned a blind eye. They basically said, well, you know, how intelligent does an animal have to be before you don't kill it? And that's a very good question. And we presented all this evidence of what we know about dolphins and why they need to be protected. The point is that the killing needs to be stopped, and the government of Japan does not want to be told what to do. And, you know, certainly we can understand that it's difficult to hear that you're doing the wrong thing. But in our own country, we had dolphins being killed in the dolphin tuna nets, if you remember. And now we have dolphin safe tuna. So we're not, you know, scientists aren't, and environmental groups are really not asking the Japanese government to do anything that we haven't asked our own government to do. And I've made the point that, you know, we have to take much more of a cosmopolitan viewpoint here. Cosmopolitan means, you know, being a citizen of the planet, a citizen of the earth. This is not a new term. Diogenes, who was a Greek philosopher in the 4th century, coined this term cosmopolitan. And he said, I'm a citizen of the planet. And that's the approach I think we need to take. We're citizens of the planet. Our science is not just science in the UK or in the United States or in Australia. Our scientific facts need to transcend all countries, all boundaries. And this is our science. Let's turn it into policy.
Diana Reese is the director of the Dolphin Research Program at the National Aquarium in Baltimore. She's the author of the book Dolphin in the Mirror. Steve Paulson spoke with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 124B, Deep Blue Sea. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Doug Gordon and Strange Champs, Sarah Nix, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll find 10 years of interviews to download and share.
PRI, Public Radio International.